Welcome back to the Jazz Standard.
Live now on Kaya 959.
We are Rhythm and Beat.
And Jazz.
Thank you. took that last breath for him. Oh, how amazing is that? Also, again, borrowing on that last song. So tender. Welcome back to the Jazz Standard here on Kai 959. Our tribute was then, in the past hour, to the sorcerer that was Jack DeJohnette, your favorite drummer's favorite drummer. And that was beautiful to just remember the trio that is an iconic marker of time, if anything else. And if you're just joining us, you're right on time for a feel-good vibe. We're anticipating the Upsuggest sessions at Marble. Preps are underway for what promises to be a sultry afternoon in the company of jazz cats and jazz giants. Master Habib Twaid is headlining this edition, and he's accompanied by Mohammed Doji on tenor saxophone, Yonel Amnana on keys, Spusisom keys on trumpet. And later on, we'll be chatting about this and hearing a little bit more about the sessions, and speaking to Teresha as well in this to tell us a little bit more about what they have planned in the future for this incredible sessions. And in this hour, it's the Blueprint interview with Mark Turner, an American tenor saxophonist celebrated for his cerebral tone, intricate harmonies, and compositional depth emerging in the 90s in the New York scene. He became one of the defining voices of modern post-bop, known for his subtle lyricism, cool intensity, and deep musical intellect. And beyond his solo projects, he's been a longtime ECM artist and a sought-after collaborator with musicians such as Ked Rosenwinkel, Avishai Cohen, and Billy Hart. So let's hear a little bit about him. We had a beautiful chat. Definitely a very intense fellow, and very thoughtful in everything that he does. Right up to even how he listens and the question lands on him, and asking for clarity so that he hears you, and you're phrasing yourself in a way that he understands, because he gives you a very well-measured and very well-thought-through answer. It was such fun talking to him. Well, he spoke a little bit about what it meant for him being in Africa. Maybe let's start there.
I've only been to the continent of Africa three times. Once I went to Angola.
Okay.
Another time I was in Morocco. Mm-hmm. You know, I was a sideman both times. And then South Africa. That's it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I mean, it's just interesting to see a tiny bit, right? I mean, you know, I don't know anything. It's just interesting to even get a tiny glimpse at all. So that's what I mean. I mean, I don't know. There's just so many layers. You can't even crack the surface. It's just deep. It's weird walking around a place where I don't feel like I have to have my papers all the time. But, right. You know, I just felt okay. Like, okay, it's fine. I wasn't stressed out in the same way. What I mean by you feel like you have to have your papers all the time is, your papers meaning, one could be identification, that's obvious, but the other one would be like, you know, the way you speak. That's a big one. Mm-hmm. It's how you speak, your vernacular of the language. That's why, if you notice, I don't speak in a typically African-American black vernacular.
Yeah.
You know, I don't use slang words. I don't. Why? Because as soon as I open my mouth, it gives me a certain amount of respect to allow me to walk into certain spaces. That's why I do it. Partially because I'd like to speak the language well, but the way you dress.
Yes.
Where you went to school. There are all these details you have to carry with you. If you're not, you know, if you're white, you can walk in the room any old way. You get accepted. It's like, oh, you're supposed to be here. But if you're, you know, if you're black, I'd say, you know, we're at the bottom. Other, I'll say phenotypes are, you know, they also have, you know, let's say if you're Asian or if you're Latino or whatever, you also have less respect, but maybe you're on a slightly higher tier. But you always have to have your card, the way you speak, the way you dress, where you went to school, where do you live, what car are you driving? You know, all those kinds of things tell the other people, especially white people, okay, you can be here. You belong here. And if you don't have them, you're suspect. Mm. Okay, that's it. That's what I mean.
Well, anyway, we're starting on a philosophical note, because that's definitely his way anyway. And being in Johannesburg, the freedom he got moving around, seeing people like him lots more, and not feeling scared for being, but just already feeling the sense of belonging. I think it's a very profound thing, considering that the album that we're reviewing is called Reflections on the Autobiography of an Ex-Colored Man. And it speaks about the same issues in terms of just what people had to do to be able to survive. It's a beautiful work of art. It's got him on on tenor sax and narration. It's got Jason Palmer on trumpet, and David Varelis plays the piano, prophet and organ, and Matt Brewer plays acoustic and electric bass, and Nasheed Waits is reigning again, you know, in terms of rhythm and everything else. A very well-selected band and of people that he trusts. Later on in the interview, he tells us about playing with his players. He tells us a little bit about the backdrop of reflections on the autobiography of an ex-colored man. What was this title about? What is the book about? And how did it make this work so important for him to bring through?
He was a civil rights activist in the earlier part of the 20th century. He was a diplomat. He spoke fluent Spanish, so he's a diplomat to the, I think there are two, forgot which ones, but two Central American countries. He was a lawyer. He's an academic. I don't remember whether he taught at, taught at least at two HBCUs. When he wrote the book, first it was anonymous because, you know, it was a scandalous kind of subject matter. And then later, I think in the 20s, maybe it was 27, 26, the book was republished with his name on it. And he also wrote the with his brother, the what's called the Negro National Anthem, Lift Every Voice and Sing. And yeah, that's about it. You know, he's kind of the elder statesman of the Harlem Renaissance. He was older than the rest of the group of people that were involved in that. Mm-hmm. And he was sort of a, you know, I would say early 20th century, late 20th century Renaissance man, mm-hmm. kind of wore many hats, was excellent at so on and so forth.
It takes one Renaissance man to see the other. We're speaking to tenor saxophonist Mark Turner's reflections on the autobiography of an ex-colored man, a powerful commentary on one of the most important voices in modern jazz. The album out on October 10th with the help of Giant Step Nonprofit. Joining him on drums, as I said, is Jason Palmer, David Varelis, Nasheed Waits. The seeds of this project go back two decades when Mark Turner discovered the autobiography of the ex-colored man by James Weldon Johnson, whom he's just described, the seminal civic rights activist, diplomat and professor. And the book is a semi-fictional account of a biracial man able to pass as white. And for Turner, it was not obstruction. He says, in my family, we talked about that all the time because my mother can pass. And also my great aunts did exactly what the protagonist does in the book. What a close story, close to home. We played your first movement one of the movements on the album earlier on when we started the interview, and that one was called Movement 9, titled Identity Politics. Here's Movement 2. It's called Juxtaposition. I hope you're enjoying it. You're on the Jazz Standard on Kai 959.
It may be said that the claim of the Southern whites that they love the Negro better than the Northern whites do is in a manner true. Northern white people love the Negro in a sort of abstract way, as a race, through a sense of justice, charity, and philanthropy. They will liberally assist in his elevation. A number of them have heroically spent their lives in this effort. Yet, generally speaking, they have no particular liking for individuals of the race. Southern white people despise the Negro as a race and will do nothing to aid in his elevation as such. But for certain individuals, they have a strong affection and are helpful to them in many ways. With these individual members of the race, they live on terms of the greatest intimacy. They entrust them with their children, their family treasures, and their family secrets. In trouble, they often go to them for comfort and counsel. In sickness, they often rely upon their care.
this affectionate relation between the Southern whites and those blacks who come into close touch with them has not been overdrawn, even in fiction. This perplexity of Southern character extends even to the mixture of the races. That is spoken of as though it were dreaded worse than smallpox, leprosy, or the plague. Yet, when I was in Jacksonville, I knew several prominent families there with large colored branches, which went by the same name and were known and acknowledged as blood relatives.
Big up to the band. I mean, how is that for being so connected and while you're playing a track called Juxtaposition? Incredible indeed. And the whole conversation is because musicians make albums every day, but statements come along far less often. Latest release by Mark Turner has crafted a magnum opus, both deeply personal and microsomatic in its explorations of social issues. Got to take a break. When I come back, a little bit more on this.
The Jazz Standard continues
with Brenda Sisane,
Kaya 959,
on the street,
on the air.
I mean, you know, I'm an avid lover of all things history and facts, you know. So I follow this particular page, and they're talking just about Mamwini Mandela, how she actually understood at a certain time during the struggle that, you know, they help us. And this is what Mark was speaking about. Our guest is Mark Turner on The Blueprint, and it's about his book, The Autobiography of an Ex-Colored Man, which is about the exploration of social issues and what people can do to survive. And Mamwini was just she started a project, which was a campaign. So all the workers and the maids and the people that make the tea in the boardrooms where decisions are being made about what to do with all these recalcitrant black people or whatever, all of in these rooms are people that are that don't exist as far as people are concerned, or should I say, you know, in the sense that the lady who pours the tea in the boardroom, in the government office, in somebody's house, you know, where you know, black maids were working. Most clues lay there about how to gain some intel as to what is going on. And that happened over a period of time. And this was the smart move by Mamwini Mandela. And I loved just reading about it and somebody actually saying a movie should be made about just what came out of, you know, being observant like that for those workers that were simply relegated to being maids. And meantime, they were providing intel to a very powerful, you know, should I say, political shaping and movement. And speaking of that, we come back to a book that traces similar story, and this book is turned into a work of art in the sense that Mark then takes some of the readings. He says it took only 12 parts to create this album, but the book itself is a deep reflection on culture and identity. He tells us a little bit about how does it translate prose into music and the directional feelings to the music.
Well, the main thing is, I'll just try to keep it short because it's a little bit long, but the main process of trying to translate the prose into music, mm-hmm. one is I didn't want it to be programmed, meaning, you know, not literal. I think there are some versions of this, doing this kind of thing, where you're literally trying to make the music sound like what you've read. So I personally don't agree with that. So that's not what I was trying to do. Why? Because most music that we've listened to, especially without words, is, you know, music is probably the most abstract of all art forms. The only time it becomes more visceral or less abstract is when it's music with words, like songs where we have lyrics, you know. Then most people attach some meaning to the music via the lyrics. But when you don't have lyrics, it's very abstract, you know, jazz, you know, other kinds of music that don't have words. That's one thing. So basically, there are 11 chapters. So the first thing was, you know, I used kind of musical techniques. So I won't get that into it because it might be a little too nerdly for some people. But basically, I separated the, I decided I was going to write 11 pieces of music, just attach the 11 chapters. And then the other thing is I started by writing an introduction. Eventually I ended up using the introduction was a development. I won't get into musical details, but the outro is a development of that. Then I reread the book, and the rest was intuitive. So I just intuitively, you know, I thought about the different sections, like what were the most important things, particularly from my personal point of view. The most important parts that that the author was trying to present. And then I intuitively decided to write music, you know, based on how I emotionally felt about it. Because the thing that's important to me, or part of doing this project, was trying to figure out the directional The directional purpose or directional directionality of the emotional, so emotional, spiritual, cultural feelings that a person has, and the how they are directly translated into music. So music meaning melody, harmony, rhythm, form. So how are those directly interpreted from the emotional, spiritual, psychological, cultural into those things? That's difficult. Most of us musicians do it in a very intuitive way. You just write a song. You're not necessarily literally thinking, well, I want to write something that feels like anger, jealousy, or some cultural aspect. You're writing music. It's abstract. Maybe you figure out exactly what it was after you wrote it. This process was a little bit maybe even on both sides, meaning the content was interesting because the content directs what I write, which most jazz musicians don't write that way. I would say the majority of us don't. So I found it a little bit more clear experience of how to connect the two in a more direct manner. So that's basically what I did. So the 11 songs, that's already directive, just deciding on 11 things to write. It ended up being 10, but one of them is sort of two songs at once. Reading the book, the material, that kind of generates the feelings and emotions, what you're thinking about, what you're thinking about culture, spirituality, and all those things. Then intuitively saying, how are you going to break those up in 11 to 10 different pieces? So, and then you might think about, you know, once you get into it, what does this chord mean? What does this section mean? What does this rhythm mean? How does it feel to you? Mm. So on and so forth.
Mm. Well, I mean, if you've been wondering how to put the book to music and just how to feel about it, I was quite well educated about that after this interview. I did thank Mark, you know, for just making me understand the place of intuition. I've always thought sort of a musician stepping out and asking myself, what happens when they pick up that instrument? The understanding that you know the message that is in what you're about to do, and you know your work as an instrumentalist or as a singer, and that the rest of it, you embody that emotion and intuitively work with it, is a kind of sense I got out of this, and it really cleared a little bit of a gray area in my understanding. I mean, I'm still not very far in all of this. I think music education is so illuminating and educational, and that just when the pin dropped, I had big smiles on my face. In fact, we had such a big chat about this stuff. What I also loved about why I love these kind of interviews is that you always constantly ask yourself, why does the music always seem to leapfrog into where it needs to go? Why is the music always switched on? And literally, it's the players themselves that keep on pivoting within the time that they live in, and really thinking about the subject matter that needs to come to the table, I think. And it's a very significant part of why we love doing these interviews. At some point, we speak about the creative and compositional process, and Mark gets carried away with this. I think I'd like to play it for you, just so for you to get a sense of his depth as a musician and the scientific and mathematical thoughts that come to his mind when he's thinking and creating, and the reason why. I mean, this man is known for incredible albums. There's one called Solos, you know, the jazz sessions, and this man is delivering work as a solo and as, you know, playing the instrument that he plays. There's Apple Blues Are Green. There's also an album called Fast, and then there's The Fury was recorded live in Brooklyn, and then you also, and I also like the way he titles his work. There's another one that is recent, literally at the heels of this one. We raise them to lift their heads. I mean, how intentional can a music be?
The main thing is, it's not that complicated. The main was, basically, just to tell you this, when I first wrote it, I wasn't intending to have any words. I was just using the novel and the prose to basically direct and shape music. So I was trying to find other ways to write music, as opposed to, you know, I'd say most musicians will just say, oh, I'm going to write a tune. It's going to be a certain amount of bars with these kind of chords. There are all kinds of compositional tools that we learn, and you just write a tune. And of course, we're humans. We're filled with emotion. And so that naturally comes into the music. You don't have to worry about that part. I think. The issue is having more directional control of it. That gets closer to mastery, is when you have the directional control of how you feel and directing that straight into music in a directional manner. That's what makes some of the masters we consider great musicians, people who have the ability to do that. It's less haphazard, let me put it that way. Okay. Simple, mm-hmm. Simply said. So that's number one. Number two, I decided to do, so there are 10, 11 pieces and there's 6 orations. And I had to keep them short. So if they become too long or there are too many of them, then the words take over the situation. I don't want that. I just wanted words that were fairly provocative, you know, because they're short. You can't, you know, these are short sections. They have to be fairly, they have to have a punch. And they have to have, how can I say it? They had to sort of, they basically had to, the content had to convey a certain point of view of at least a few sections of the book. I couldn't do all of it. Otherwise, then, you know, it would be an opera. I'm not writing an opera. So I just had to take a few potent sections of the book that would relay certain ideas of the author, and I personally felt that were important to bring about in the book. So that's number two. Second is the proportions. So music is, a lot of music is about that. It's basically geometry and sound in some way. You know, it's about proportions. That's when people talk about math and music, a lot of it is that. So, you know, it's basically the proportion of, you know, I didn't want half. It's kind of like a golden mean curve a little bit. So if anyone who knows what the golden mean is, it's a little bit like that. It's a little bit more than half, basically. Mm-hmm. 10 songs and 6 orations. Could have been 7, but that's a little too much. So that's the other thing. The rest is I would say, just more intuitive for the listener. It's just, you know, potent expression of the words. The content needs to be somewhat potent.
Yeah.
If you notice, it happens like, it's not on every, sometimes there's a song and then another song. There's not an oration after every song, right? That would make, you need some, how can I put it? It's a little bit like the blues, or a lot of forms have somewhat of, there'll be evenness. So the blues has 12 bars, but it's also uneven. It's in 3 sections. And music often, especially music from, you know, I would say African diasporic music, there's always a combination between 2s and 3s. It's partially what makes swing. Sorry, I'm getting a little too involved in this, but the 2 and 3 element, or duple and triple, is a lot of what the music that came from the African continent went into the music of the Americas, not just North America, but the whole continent, has a lot to do with that. Mm. The blues form is actually directly related to that. 2s and 3s. So anyway, so I wanted that relationship that's similar. So basically something that has some sense of evenness, but also slightly uneven. Mm. It's too even and you don't want to go back to it again. If it's slightly uneven with some symmetry on some sides, then it's something that it becomes circular.
K959 at 1338, speaking to tenor player Mark Turner, who is telling us a little bit about the album and autobiography of an ex-colored man, and his reflections on it, because there's a title of the album, really. But now that it becomes a story of how to create that work, it becomes very interesting. I hope you're keeping up and, with all of that. And maybe for those like me who want a simple way of saying, why are we bothering about this album? Here's the reason. And of course, it's called Pragmatism as a title, Movement 8 from the album.
But there is one thing I did not mention. Among Negroes themselves, there is a peculiar inconsistency of the color question. Its existence is rarely admitted and hardly ever mentioned. It may not be too strong a statement to say that the greater portion of the race is unconscious of its influence.
Yet this influence, though silent, is constant. It is evidenced most plainly in mirrored selection. Thus, the black men generally marry women fairer than themselves, while, on the other hand, the dark women, of stronger mental endowment, are very often married to light-complexioned men. The effect is a tendency toward lighter complexions, especially among the more active elements of the race. Some might claim that this is a tacit admission of colored people among themselves of their own inferiority, judged by the color line. I do not think so. What I have termed an inconsistency is, after all, most natural. It is, in fact, a tendency in accordance with what might be called an economic necessity. For as far as racial differences go, the United States puts a greater premium on color, or better, lack of color, than upon anything else in the world. To paraphrase, have a white skin and all things else may be added unto you. I once heard a colored man sum it up in these words. It's no disgrace to be black, but it's often very inconvenient.
Has become my go-to, you know, just since discovering this album a few weeks ago. Well, you're on the Jazz Standard. We're enjoying great vibes from the Absa Jazz Sessions at Marvel and giving you bespoke jazz and great conversations. And, of course, the interviews are on point and they speak to the storylines that is all about what we do on a Sunday afternoon, where jazz is a vehicle to create magic in your mind and perhaps even into your life. Just listen to Mark Turner's beautiful work and this autobiographical work. I just asked him a few questions as we wrapped up the interview. One of them was about what is in his band and why, you know, where he continues to work with his band. But also, finally, we did ask a question on behalf of you, the listener, to say what do the audiences take away from his music. So he had something to say about that. We wrap up the interview and also introduce an incredible man, taken from Joshua Redman, Where Are We? The project is a luminous reflection on identity, melody, and the beauty of connection across cultures, a fitting echo conversation. Tenor sound often leans towards introspection and quiet architecture, while Mr. Redman's tone glows with lyricism and warmth, and yet they meet in the same pursuit, truth, originality and melody. And of course, in Omo, you can hear the same spirit of curiosity and grace that defines their generation. Artists unafraid to listen deeply, to reinvent and to honor where the music comes from. So here's from the Turner saying goodbye to you about his band and what you should think of his music. And when I come back, we play Joshua Redman, and after that we speak a little bit more about the Absa Sessions in Marble. I think if you want to be a fly on the wall, this is an opportunity for you. We'll be chatting about that shortly. Stay tuned.
They're all people I've played with before as a sideman or as a leader. So we're all in a musical social group, you know, of about, I don't know how many people, but tens of people. And so we all play with each other in different musical situations. Sometimes the music is more straight ahead, maybe sometimes a little more avant-garde. Sometimes it's more like modern mainstream. So I played with everyone before, and I usually pick, if that helps, the listener listening to this, I usually pick people to play with based on their musical personality. Of course, their ability, obviously, but... And I pick people who I don't have to tell. I don't have to tell them what to do. Mm-hmm. I can hear they're playing. I played with them. I already know what they're going to do. I don't talk much about it. I just say, this is the tune. This is the form. It's straight or swing or whatever there needs to be said. I don't tell people how to play. So, because I already, you know, I pick people who I know their personalities. You know, it's like getting together. I'll make an analogy. It might be like getting five people together. We're going to go on an adventure together to a certain place. And, you know, maybe we have to, go through some towns. Maybe we have to go through some dangerous places. Maybe we have to climb some mountains. And I know that I can trust these four other individuals to get us all to that place. Maybe it's 1,000 miles. Maybe it's some kind of religious pilgrimage or something. And I can trust these people to get to that place because I know they all have certain strengths about them in taking this adventure, right? Maybe someone is, you know, one of them is a great mountain climber. One of them is a great martial artist to fight if we run into some robbers. Maybe another person is savvy socially to figure out what to do if you're in a situation in a town and we have to get out of trouble or we have to find out where to go next. You understand what I'm saying?
Got it.
Musically, that's what I'm thinking about musically. What do these people have that help us get to this place musically? So the place might be the music that I've written. I hear some kind of a idea of a place where I'd like to get musically, and I know that these individuals will help me get there. I don't know exactly how we're going to do it, but I know that they're the ones that are equipped to do it. The first thing I would say is I think this is true of anything I've ever done, any music that I'm involved in or any art. But I would say in general, maybe this one is a little bit more directed towards certain aspects of culture and belonging and those kinds of things. I would just like people to listen to it and, you know, kind of come out the other side of listening to it being different than when they entered. So it could be something like, for example, in terms of art, if you go to a art performance, maybe you go to the theater, you go to dance, or it could be maybe you enter a religious experience, maybe you see a shaman or a preacher that you like, or maybe you go to a meditative retreat, or maybe you enter a, you know, some kind of cultural musical dance experience in whatever culture you're from. You enter it, you come back reborn something out. You come out as something different. I wouldn't say reborn, but you come out as someone different. You've had an experience, you're changed afterwards. Now, I'm not going to direct what that change is. I just like people to, that's what I would like. I wanted to have that kind of impact.
Mr. Turner, and please, please pay attention, check out his work. Start with this new album that we've just introduced, but also go back into time into his work. He's a marvel to listen to. He's together with a friend of his, and I don't know, because they are playing similar instruments. It's called Umu, and I think Umu Sangari, as a woman, should be happy that she's seen in this light by all these musicians from across the world. I think you know that Carl Shepherd in South Africa has also made a dedication to Umu Sangari. Very beautiful woman. And she was here in South Africa recently. It's simply called Umu. Thank you. Well, that is Joshua Redman, as we said to you. That is a beautiful marriage of words there. I mean, should I say of instruments? The time is 7:57. I'm rounding off with a short commercial break. When I come back, great conversations that have to do, speaking to the wonderful Sadiqa Fakir about the Upsa Jazz sessions at Marble. So stay tuned for that.